This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson, testifying that his then-boss not only knew but made decisions on paying a porn star hush money to keep quiet about an affair, Donald Trump's former attorney and fixer Michael Cohen at the New York criminal trial. At the courthouse, ABC's Aaron Katursky.
Cohen told the jury Trump didn't seem to care how it would affect his marriage, saying, "How long do you think I'll be on the market for?" "Not long." He wasn't thinking about Melania, Cohen said. This was all about the campaign. Trump claims he never had sex with a porn star, but Cohen insisted Trump gave him clear directions. Pay Daniels to keep quiet, saying there's no reason to keep this thing out there. Just do it.
Cohen scheduled back on the stand tomorrow. President Biden's expected to quadruple tariffs on electric vehicles from China and raise other tariffs on semiconductors, solar, batteries, and more in an announcement tomorrow. Closed a runway at Houston's Hobby Airport so a crew can repair damage from a lightning bolt. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Canadian wildfire smoke is back. That's why skies were hazy over Wisconsin Monday. Air quality alerts were issued for several counties. The Department of Natural Resources says small particles may make air unhealthy for some people, especially the very young, the very old, and people with heart or lung conditions. Most rural voters favor economic policies that lower costs and raise incomes for the working class. Patrick Toomey helped conduct a new poll for Breakthrough Campaigns.
Just cutting taxes and getting rid of regulations is not going to do the most to help me in this economy.
The poll shows rural voters agree with many Democratic policy positions, but think Republicans are doing more for working people. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
So I have super parallel parking skills. And on the east side where I live, I will often sit on my front porch and like a play-by-play call as if it was a sport. Parallel parking to me is a sport. I'm the Stephen A. Smith of parallel parking. That should go on a t-shirt.
We'll get you one made.
Oh my gosh.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is the Talk of La Crosse. Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Hope everyone had a wonderful Mother's Day and a great weekend. And to all the hardworking moms out there who juggle careers, responsibilities, and, well, their endless love for their families, your dedication, your strength, your love are truly, truly inspiring. So I hope you were able to take a moment on Mother's Day, celebrate all that you do, and know that your efforts do not go unnoticed. So I hope you had some joy, some relaxation. Hope Dad and the kids took care of you a little bit. Someone asked me what'd you get your wife for Mother's Day. I said nothing. She's not my mother. That not the right attitude. We had a lovely day, did the whole dinner with the in-laws. It was a great get together. And my wife runs away to do her scrapbooking thing for Mother's Day. That's the best gift, men, that you can give your wives. Let them go away. I want to hear your thoughts. What did you do for Mother's Day for your special mother? I'd like to hear it. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. But seriously, hope everyone had a wonderful day and filled with memories. Now, let's start this week off with something interesting. The Sunday shows were full of... they were full of... That's the right answer right there. But I got hit over the weekend A friend is writing an article, and I saw it on the Sunday show, and it's this narrative that the Biden campaign doesn't have a message, that they need to re-energize their labor base, how can they save their labor messaging? And as I've said, look, you know, the reality is Democrats have a really good message. They have done a lot. And look, the polling that we talked about last week on all of the things that Biden has gotten ushered through, the historic investments and the massive legislation that he was able to usher through our broken system, is truly historic and transformational. And the problem is nobody knows about it. And as I was saying, you know, the reality is Trump was masterful at messaging. Give him credit. There's a guy who knows this, how to suck all the oxygen out of the room and make it all about him. To where a lot of my red hat friends believe Trump did all of the things that Biden has done. That he himself rebuilt our infrastructure. Everything's fine. Trump did it. Trump himself reshored all this manufacturing and all these chip productions and all of these plants that are being built around the country. That's because of Trump. And, you know, of course, he did all this work for the middle class and, you know, all this stuff that he talked about and talked about. And did I say talked about? And he talked about it a lot. And had held weeks. There was, you know, infrastructure week every week and manufacturing week. There are all these weeks and all of these photo ops and all of these gimmicks and all of these schemes and all of this stuff. Not a lot of action. You know, when I was a kid, you know, you'd say someone was all talk and no action. That's Donald Trump. Now, the flip side of that is Joe Biden. All action, no talk. And the problem is Democrats don't do enough, you know, like the labor movement doesn't. They don't do enough of tooting their own horn, saying, hey, look what we did. And then standing by it and being proud of it. The Affordable Care Act. I remember saying when they were getting beat up, because understand, the right-wing messaging machine, real powerful. They have the ability to set a narrative. And Democrats didn't understand. It's a street fight, man. And as I've said in the past, you know, in a street fight, most Democrats will offer to hold your coat. Instead of getting in there, balling up their digits and swinging away. Even if you take a couple of shots, you got to get out there and you've got to swing away. Understand, now the Affordable Care Act, people are going, hey, that was actually not bad. We should do more. We should do better, which we should have been doing years ago. But first we had to go through that period of people finding out what it is. Because, well, Democrats don't have the messaging vehicle. They don't have the ability to tell their story unfiltered. We have a series of Sunday shows, you know, the Democratic messaging broken and how do they reach the voters? They rely on the mainstream corporate controlled media. You know, you look at inflation. You know, I hear everyone complaining, you know, inflation's completely out of control. You know, the cost of meat is, you know, through the roof. Yet, you know, the reality is almost 85% of meat production in this country is done by four companies. You know, soda's through the roof. You know, it's almost more than gasoline. Yet, three companies control more than 90% of the soda market. Cereal, same thing. You know, breakfast cereal through the roof. Yet, three companies control almost three quarters of that industry. We keep hearing about this, you know, air travel. You got four airlines that control the entire thing. We've got all this monopolization, all this consolidation. And why don't we hear about it? Well, because you've got what? Six major corporations that control 90% of everything we see, hear, and read? Do you think we got a messaging vehicle problem? Not a messaging problem. They've got a great message. And the analogy I used, it's like, you know, buying your kid the greatest Christmas present ever. And it's sitting in an Amazon warehouse because there's no UPS driver to deliver it. This is where the Democrats find themselves. They've got to get out there and they've got to do the work. Look, it's a lot of hard work. Social media, you know, radio, TV. You've got to build the environment. You've got to get out there and do it. No one's going to come do it for you. I know my labor friends, a lot of them like free media, which means they hold an event and all the six corporations that control 90% of everything we see, hear, and read will then come. If we build it, they will come. No, no, you've got to have your own megaphones. And this is what the right understands masterfully, which is why they control and dominate talk radio, which is why they control and dominate cable news, which is why social media is so overwhelmingly tilted towards crazy right-wing messaging. There's a reason for it, because they invested it. They spend a lot of time putting it together, making it interesting and entertaining and worth consuming. And oh, by the way, they're coordinated. They're all reading from the same book. They're all on the same page, in the same paragraph, on the same sentence at the same time. Whereas Democrats, the left, labor, however you want to put that, they're fighting fires. They're putting out fires. They're fighting individual battles, trying to win battles instead of the war. We silo up. I've got mine. You've got yours. We're going to work, you know, on our thing. Whereas the right understands empire. They understand dominance. And we had better figure this out quickly, because there isn't a messaging problem. There isn't a message problem that Biden has, because, again, he's done some really great stuff, really worthy of being screamed from the mountaintop. We've got a messaging vehicle problem. It's getting to enough people, and the time and repetition that it takes to get people to go, oh yeah, the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, actually did some stuff to help climate change. That infrastructure bill. Oh yeah, that's why this road and this highway is getting finished. Oh yeah, that's why this is happening. You need somebody who's talking to working class voters and not at them or through them. And this is what the right believes. This is what Republican-leaning voters think that the right's messaging machine does. We got work to do, folks. Lots of it. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to come back. China back in the news. We're going to talk about China hungry. Is this a dangerous marriage? Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So last week, Chinese President Xi Jinping and the Hungarian President Viktor Orban held meetings, several days actually, that ended with effusive praise and pats on the back and oh, how they love each other. Now, understand, NATO, Hungary, NATO, they're one of the NATO members. So it's kind of interesting to see a NATO member signing on to what the Financial Times reported as an all-weather comprehensive strategic partnership for the new era. And that partnership with China will serve more than mere semantic importance. And you go, what does all-weather mean with this strategic comprehensive? What I guess it means, according to Xi Jinping world, It means now that Budapest is now one of China's members. According to the Financial Times, they are now one of those countries that do most to support China's effort to, get this, folks, to counter U.S. power, and which are increasingly rewarded with investment, trade, and diplomatic support. And here to share some thoughts on if this is a big deal or much ado about nothing on my part, I've asked our good friend Emily Delabria to come talk with us. She is the chief cook and bottle washer over there at Horizon Advisory. Emily, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me. Mostly bottle washer.
So, co-founder and important person there. Let's go with that. Is this a big deal? Am I looking at this going, you know, a NATO member, you know, kind of breaking away, China increasing its strategic, footprint? Anything to worry about here?
Definitely things to worry about. Hungary's relationship with China is actually super interesting. And this kind of closeness is not new. Hungary has for a long time now been one of China's main partners in Europe and has served, and I'll talk about this more, but has served as kind of like a on the side fall guy for EU countries that are closer with the US to continue to have relations with China. And as like the bad guy in the EU who's going to keep advocating close ties with China so that the other countries can say that they're advocating for the opposite. So in that context, this isn't surprising at all. It's not really a departure from the norm, although that norm itself is interesting and a big deal. The one thing that is notable is the explicit nature of this. Hungary isn't trying to hide its close relationship with Beijing. And I think that speaks to a reality that the reading of the current environment with the EU, with the US, with the broader global environment is that it's okay. And you can explicitly go hug Xi Jinping and say, we're your all-weather friends, even as a NATO member and EU country.
Yeah, but it seems like is it possible to serve two masters, so to speak, to be on both sides of the coin, a NATO member and still yet, maybe I just don't understand, but it seems like it's kind of hard to be in both places then.
The calculus from Hungary's perspective, and I think which is accurate, is that NATO is not going to enforce a hard stance on China, that there isn't the willingness from the EU or even from the US right now to say it's them or us. And that's like the biggest thing that has to change about the US international posture vis-a-vis China is right now it's possible for countries and even NATO member countries to play both sides, and not only to play both sides, but to play China's side, which is what Hungary is doing. And no one is willing to really step in and say, you can't do that.
So I shouldn't be too hard on Hungary. You're saying that other countries get away with this as well, and we just haven't enforced it in any administration, Trump, Obama, Bush, any of that.
Yes, I think Hungary is a particularly notable example, but also what Hungary is doing isn't just Hungary. Like, they're buds with China with the support of Germany, for example, because Hungary's economic relationship with China lets Germany have an economic relationship with China and prevents the international organizations Germany is part of from themselves taking a stricter line on China. So you have to think about Hungary as kind of like the, little sibling who's being like encouraged to do quote unquote bad things because it's convenient for the older siblings. And that way they're not the ones that get in trouble.
Interesting frame. Now, the reason I thought this was important is I'm looking at, this relationship with China, but I'm also looking at the last couple of years, CPAC, Crazy PAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee folks who we've come to know, love, and mock here at home. They've been doing their conventions and their outreach in Hungary. In fact, just not too long ago, you had CPAC Hungary 2024, where you brought all the crazies together there for a future where, it seems like Hungary is the model that they want to pursue here at home.
Well, I definitely think like Hungary and the conservative party or establishment in the US have had good relationships. Like Trump and Orban had a great relationship. I think it raises, that in turn raises really interesting questions of, if we had a Republican administration, whether Hungary would come closer to the U.S. or not. Like, is the U.S. conservative establishment going to use its close ties to countries like Hungary to bring them closer to the U.S., or are they going to go in the direction that those countries are and themselves become closer to China or closer to Russia? And I mean, in the same way that it's not really clear, if you look at, you know, what past presidential policy on international partners and their relationships with China, what, you know, it's not really clear that they've forced the line and forced a them or us thing. It's kind of unclear how those close ties would or would not be used.
So, you know, if I'm getting this right, you know, a move toward Trump, and which I believe would be a move towards more authoritative leadership, more more dictatorial kind of control at the federal level here, and our friends and allies would be more rewarded for that same kind of behavior. I'm trying to put this nicely. Basically, you're playing in the dictator pond.
I think a big question is also, like, you know, moving up a level, how U.S. leaders use their personal relationships and their personal closeness to advance U.S. interests or not advance U.S. interests. Like, we kind of see it as generally, like, regardless of the other country and regardless of the administration, as a positive when a U.S. president has a good relationship with another important state leader. So, like, Biden and President Macron in France was a great example, right? That was espoused in media as fantastic. It was a bromance. Everyone liked it. But that's only a positive if that relationship is being used to make sure that that other country is acting in a way that's beneficial to U.S. interests,
right?
Like, a partnership for the sake of partnership, if you're talking about international relations, there's no actual value in that. So it has to be used to bring that country into the international order and the international norms that the U.S. is trying to advance. And I think it's unclear right now whether that's what would, you know, whether the U.S. is going to do that with dictators or not.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, I'm looking at this situation and I see all bad in the event that Trump becomes president, but that's just, I guess, my bias. And what I'm looking for is someone to say, no, Rick, relax, you know this is the natural order of the international community. You know, we have these checks and balance and these things that work out, and but I'm not feeling all warm and fuzzy.
I think, like, you know, on this particular question, there could, like, I guess my point is, it could be a positive. It could be a positive in any of these things, right? If we have people in power in the U.S. who are going to leverage relationships, again, to bring countries back on their side, but that's not, like, we don't know that's going to happen at any point. And so, like, I think the even bigger question isn't, you know, what's their relationship with this other country, whether that be a democracy or non-democracy. It's, are the people who are in power in the U.S. going to use their relationships abroad and their diplomatic clout abroad to advance U.S. interests, or just to be buds and to go to a path of least resistance? And that doesn't even seem to be a party thing. It's just like a leadership thing.
Well, we'll see how this goes. I got an email I wanted to address with you, because I got an email from someone who said that I'm being hyperbolic and that I'm being hairs on fire when I talk about trade with China. That they believe that China is, our trade deficits have actually fallen. They believe that what I'm saying, or what we've actually talked about, is much ado about nothing, considering that steel imports, they say, are down from China year after year, and that you know, this imaginary threat of EVs and all of this dumping, that we're just imagining what's going to happen instead of it actually happening. And I got, and my response was clear. I maybe all that is true, but we know from the past what China has done, and we know what they're saying they will do. So it doesn't seem to me to be hyperbolic, but I did want to get your thoughts.
Yeah, I think there are two questions there. The first is, are those figures true or not? And the second is, what's the actual threat from China and how do we face it? On the first question, you can't just look at the direct trade figures with China. U.S. trade with China has gone down over the past stretch, a year, 2 years. But if you look at indirect trade with China, the figures have gone up. U.S. trade with Mexico has gone up, China's trade with Mexico has gone up. Beijing's really good at getting around the first order of our defenses.
Good game of whack-a-mole.
And so then you get to what the actual threat is and how you measure U.S. exposure to it. Right now, the U.S. can't make anything important without China. And right now, the business models of every major U.S. company or that makes anything, which is to say the foundation of the U.S. economy, depend on selling into China. And that means that China controls our economy and therefore controls our country. And we know that Beijing is going to use that control to hurt us.
I gotta have you say that again. We can't make anything of significance without China?
Find me something. We can't supply our military without China. Things that we're sending over to Ukraine to arm them depend on supply chains that are tied with China. We can't make an electric vehicle, let alone an electric vehicle battery, without China. 90% of our solar industry is controlled by Chinese production. Any major strategic industry, China has worked to make sure that it has leverage over at least one key node of that value chain.
Now, for those who haven't been paying attention for the last 20 years, you know, how did we get to this? I mean, you know, this is a major, because look, I remember a time where all the toys used to be made in the U.S. and all the bikes and, you know, everything was made somewhere in the U.S. And you knew where that stuff was made. How so quickly did we go from the producer of the world to this dependent then?
We didn't value manufacturing at home, and China realized that they could take advantage of that to control global industry. And whoop, there it went.
That and corporate greed, because, hey, there's more money over there and they've been subsidizing heavily. So this idea, and this is where I wanted to go with this idea that it hasn't happened yet is the same rhetoric that got us into the mess that we're in. Oh, it won't happen. It hasn't happened yet. Don't worry. Granted, we know what's coming, but don't worry. Just head in the sand.
Yeah. Again, because we don't value, right? Like, not valuing production in the U.S., our ability to produce, that means it's okay to just make more money, even if that means shipping production overseas, right? Like, that changes the calculus so that you let, like, your profit-seeking or greed be what drives a shift in production. And it's the same thing with the, like, it hasn't happened yet, right? Like, our economy hasn't, I mean, it has disintegrated in a lot of ways, but, like, you know, the country hasn't fully fallen apart because of China. I would argue there's a lot going on that's a huge problem and that's tearing our country apart because of China, but it's not like a one-to-one and we're in collapse right now. However, China controls all of our economy. And I would say that means that it has happened.
That is not what I wanted to hear. but the truth of the matter is it's what we know. And we've been talking about this for a very long time. And every time I hear it, I get angry. Because I think about all my flag-waving friends, all my friends who wear the American flag shirt made in China, and all of this. And I go, you know, there is common ground here. There is something that could unite us if only we chose this instead of all the stuff that divides us.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't get this, right? To my mind, and I realize, like, I'm a one-trick pony, like I only look at one thing, but any major issue that people are talking about in America and care about, to my mind, like, it's a function of China. Like, polarization that's, you know, leading to the current political, whatever we're going to call it, like, chaos, disaster, I argue, like, why is that? It's because our economy is stratified because of China and because we don't have manufacturing. Like, environmental questions, look at China, look at their polluting, look at their control over new energy value chains. Like, it's all China. And I don't understand how we can't just have everybody realize that their number one issue is probably a function of China distorting our system and attacking us as a country, and then make this what we care about.
So do you see this coming up in this election? I mean, we're just about 6 months out. Do you see this being an issue at the front, or sadly, as I fear, this gets pushed to the back, because it's not grabbing headlines. It's not what the Sunday shows are about. It's not what talk radio is focusing on. I'm curious your thought.
I mean, I think at the narrative level, to the extent that there is a conversation about policy, and I'm not sure there will be a conversation about policy, but to the extent that there is, yes, China will be in there. But I don't think, well, A, there's first of all, is there a conversation about policy? And second of all, to the extent that it's discussed, it's going to be like the mouth service, the lip service. People saying, oh, I did this on China, I did that on China. By people, I mean candidates. There's not going to be an actual measurement of actions. And that's what's been missing from U.S. policy on China over the past decade, is we've been saying the right thing and we haven't been doing anything.
Frustrating, angering. But again, not shocking, not surprising. It is where we are. But Emily, I appreciate the thoughts, the input. I am sure this is something we will be talking about well in through this election cycle. So I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'd love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Is she right? Does everything go back to China? All of our problems, can we trace that? Can we draw that straight line? I think she's right. I want to hear your thoughts, though. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, lacrosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Tonight, mostly clear, low in the upper 40s. Sunshine's back tomorrow, nice day with highs in the low 70s. A mix of sun and clouds, chance of storms late Wednesday, high mid-70s. Shower and thunderstorm chances continue Wednesday night, and a slight rain chance for Thursday. Currently at 62 degrees.
Smokey the Bear.
Then you know why Smokey tells you when he sees you passing through. Remember, please be careful, it's the least that you can do.
It's what you decide, don't play with matches, don't play with fire.
After 80 years of learning his wildfire prevention tips, Smokey Bear lives within us all. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com, and remember,
only you can prevent wildfires.
Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, you know you're done. You know politically it's over when Fox News starts asking real questions. I don't know if you saw it, but Stuart Varney, who I'm not a fan of by any stretch of the imagination, host of the Fox Business Show, had South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem on. Yeah, her again. Still trying to pimp the book, and I give her credit. She's trying. And Varney asked her if she had ever talked to Trump about killing her 14-month-old puppy, and she lost her mind. She said, "This interview's ridiculous, which you are doing right now. So you need to stop," she said. It is okay, she said. It is. Let's talk about some real topics that Americans care about. Turns out, Americans care if you shoot a puppy in the face. Who would have known? Who would have known? Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst, Bob Nang. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Any thoughts on the puppy shooter?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it made interesting radio for me. The shows that I called, I knew you would know this, but the other shows that I did, the hosts, I would throw out this question. I said, "Now, what did it do to Mitt Romney's career?" And they're like, "What are you talking about?
Don't roof rack me, bro."
Right. There was a dog on the roof. I won't go through all the details.
Poor Seamus.
Dog diarrhea occurred. It was on the roof for 12 hours. He stopped, blah, blah, blah. And they're like jaw dropping. "You got to be kidding me." I said, "No." Now, but Mitt didn't shoot the dog. All right. She shot the dog. There's the other thing. You know, I've had dogs, my kids, I had dogs for, I've had so many dogs. I can't name all of them. Okay. When one of them became a problem, or if it tried to bite somebody, or, you know, if it got sick, we went to a vet and they humanely put it down, all right, with the shot. That's what people normally do. What amazed me, Rick, was her ability to think by putting this in the book, she showed, I'm tough. Look at me. I shot my puppy. You got to vote for me. I'm seriously, that's where her mind went. The Kim Jong-un thing is just completely bizarre.
Just stupid. And the thing is, I saw another interview where the woman kept asking her, going, look, right. you read the book. You did the reading. You did the audiobook. Right. It's your voice. You read it. We know you read it. We hear you. You heard you read it. Why didn't you stop right then and go, wait a minute, this isn't right.
Right, right. Yeah, she can't explain it.
It's crazy.
But that's the other thing. Why would you put something like Kim Jong-un, of all things, in a book? You know, you meet famous people, and they may not recall, for example, that they met you, but you know where you met them and what the circumstances are. Kim Jong-un, you'd remember just for his haircut alone, all right? That's a keeper.
I love that on the internet they put her next to, George Santos. Maybe that's who she thought Kim Jong-un was. I don't know. But it just goes to show, that they have ghostwriters who do all this stuff. And it really isn't about the content. It's about just throwing stuff against the wall. And they generally get away with it. Turns out Americans do care about shooting puppies. A rare that we, across party lines, care about something. But this is the bridge too far.
That was it. Oh, and when I cringed when I thought, why did she go do that? The other thing is you can take it to shelters where you say, well, the dog misbehaves, it doesn't hunt well, or it tried to bite somebody. Then they make the decision too. Yeah. Is this a dog that it can be, rehabilitated, can be adopted or not? You don't just take it out and shoot it.
Yeah, someone did tell me that maybe this was her ploy to get the gig at the NRA. Maybe this is that stepping stone.
Yeah, maybe.
You never know. I think we talked about this a long time ago, and it's really not surprising. I think everyone knew it was coming. But the court case, the Trump court case, indefinitely suspended by the woman down there in Florida.
Right. You have several things. You have that, leaving Smith's case, which is now being punted eventually by the Supreme Court down, which then the lower courts make decisions on what's immunity or not. And that's almost on a item by item, which forces the Justice Department to basically go back and recarve, quote, the indictment. All right. That's a very potential scenario. Now, if that happens, we know that court case is obviously shot till, using the Governor Noem expression, but it's shot till after the election. Leaving the Fannie Willis case, I won't even go there. That one's got a problem. Leaving the Stormy Daniels case. So there's basically, right now, one case obviously going to be decided before, and you can... I watched, the testimony, the reaction, et cetera. The judge's statements in themselves where, Trump's attorneys didn't object enough. The judge kind of pointed that out. You can see, if not motions continuing of mistrial, you can see appeal in big letters after this trial,
sure.
No matter how it comes out.
Yeah, and right? The judge declined to declare a mistrial. So this is going to continue to go forward. And you're right. The other part of this is, look, maybe on appeal. So the hope and the dream of some that Trump may end up in jail, which I don't think is ever going to happen. But there is, I guess, some threat of potentially because of him not being able to shut up. What is this, his 10th violation of the gag order?
Right. And the $1,000 fine each. I want to throw something out here. And I made some of my friends heads explode by saying this, but I'll say it. If I put myself in Biden's shoes, all right? First of all, if this judge looks at contempt via the jail process, which, they've hinted at, versus the monetary process, which isn't working, he's getting $1,000 fines. Maybe the judge needs to up it to 10K each time. I don't know. But I think in my mind, very clearly, if he jails Trump, it's done. And what I mean by that, Trump, not haters, but people who dislike Trump, and they may not be sold on Biden, but they don't like him. The whole scenario of, I mean, it'd be interesting, a lot of memes, a lot of radio show stuff we could talk about, but the whole jailing and the jumpsuit and the Secret Service having to go into the jail and all the mechanics, just, it would be a martyr kingdom for Trump.
Yeah,
he would turn into a martyr.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. Oh, boy. And well, you got Fox News kind of hoping for this. You know, what was that idiot I can't stand? What's his name? Jesse Waters. Saying he'll come out, he'll be all prison buff. I'm going, what? but that's they're trying to prepare the audience for Trump going to jail. I don't think it's going to happen. I seriously don't. But you know, on any level, he's never going to spend a day behind bars. I just don't see that happening.
Here's my Biden theory. Hear me out for 1 second before you laugh too hard. If the outside chance happens that Trump is put in jail, wonder if President Biden came out and said, look, you know, I personally think he's guilty, and I think this and I think that, but no, he needs to not be in jail. I mean, I'm just throwing that out there. What reaction would be, what would happen?
Yeah. Or, you know, just, you know, Biden comes out and just says, you know what, I'm preemptively pardoning him of everything on the federal level. We're just going to move on. Let's deal with this in the election. I don't know how he would react.
I was just looking at the Stormy Daniels case, but you make a very other interesting point.
Yeah, I mean, this, we'll see. I mean, it'll be... Even if he is found guilty, it's going to be years of appeals and all kinds of legal maneuvering. Sure. I think this is the only case that's going to get a decision before the election, because clearly the documents case is delayed indefinitely. As you pointed out, the thing in Georgia is a mess. This is going to be it.
Okay. Georgia had, to me, and I said this from day one, Georgia was the toughest case for Trump. Especially Georgia law, the governor can't pardon. You have to do mandatory 5 years before it's considered, et cetera. Georgia tended to be the most delicate case, and we all know what happened there. And now it's, you know, going to be retooled, and that's the end of that before the election.
Yeah. Well, we won't have anything going on May 17th because for the first time, as I'm reading, the first time in Trump's family history. Trump will be going to, I guess, has asked to go to one of his children's graduations. I guess he hasn't gone to any of the other ones, but he's going to Barron's. Before or after the Minnesota Republican Party's Lincoln-Reagan dinner.
Well, I mean, to look at it as a dad, you know, you have children. So to look at it as a dad, you look at the other two and you're like, okay, I'm going to correct some mistakes on the third boy. You know what I mean? You know, more of a chance with Barron, huh?
No. And look, the kid looks just like him. So maybe that's it. Maybe that's the, that's the difference. Right. Maybe he thought the other two looked like the mailman. I don't know. But hey, we now find out what Trump will do in his second term. He says he plans to send kill teams into Mexico. To fight the war on drugs.
I mean, it's amazing.
I'm not making that
up. At least he tied it to drugs and not just people trying to, you know, walk to the border. I mean, he did tie it to drugs. So some people say, oh, okay, that sounds good. You got to stop drugs at any cost. Now we all know it's not going to work. But, you know, he just has this amazing ability for the right or the wrong of it, or continue to be in the headlines.
Yeah, no, the guy,
he doesn't.
He grabs the oxygen out of the room. I got to get your thoughts on Marjorie Three Names, Marjorie Taylor Greene, evidently backing down, and kind of softening her threats against Mike Johnson, the speaker, saying she can give him a little bit more time. He needs to demonstrate his commitment to conservatism, but she's going to give him the benefit of the doubt for a little bit.
Well, she wants several things. She wants the Hastert rule. Now, I was in the room when the, quote, Hastert rule was created. Hastert was Speaker of the House. And they created this rule. And when I say they, some of the right of the right, because at that time, as you know, we had 50, what we would call, well, we were called squishes, but we had 50 pro-labor Republicans and 50 Republicans, 50. And I know that because they would sign each letter when we got mad about something, like when Bush tried to take away prevailing wage off of federal projects, you know. So those 50 were the moderates. Well, the conservatives got tired of the group of 50 winning on amendments, et cetera, that were really good amendments, you know, but they weren't conservative enough for them. So they created this Hastert rule. And when we would make certain amendments, you know, applicable to the floor of the House, we would get Democrat votes, not all of them, Rick, but we would get a large portion of votes, all right, because they were centrist amendments. So they created the Hastert rule. You can't pass anything unless you pass it with the Republican majority. So under this infamous Hastert rule, which is not a piece of law in the House, it's not an official rule, but under the Hastert rule, you bring something to the floor that only Republicans can pass. You don't need Democrat votes. Well, in today's House, that's impossible. That's what Marjorie Taylor Three Names wants. She wants that. So, you know, I don't know what the Speaker says to her on that, but I don't know how you do that. There'll be nothing moving. Number two, she also had wanted, trying to remember, I can't remember the second thing she wanted. Do you remember what she wanted? I know the Hastert rule was one of them. There was some other demand she had that was basically, you know, almost frivolous. So anyway.
Well, part of it was Johnson's commitment not to fund Ukraine. Part of it was defunding Jack Smith. Part of it was, you know, the advancing legislative priorities that were already supported by the majority of the majority, which is what you're talking about, the Hastert rule. So, you know, that's the whole Ukraine thing was kind of that.
I forgot about the Ukraine. Yeah, I forgot about that. Now, it's interesting. She wants him to commit not to do Ukraine money. He can pretty well commit to that before November, probably. All right. So I think it was her way of going in, and she went in with Massey and Green, other members of Congress, the other two that support her, and she's down to about two or three, and she went into that meeting looking for a way out, even though she doesn't normally care. I think, Rick, she was looking for a way out, because if she brings up the motion, the Speaker is going to get one pass on this. This I know for sure. One pass only from the Democrats, because the Democrat caucus is starting to rumble, saying, wait a minute, we're not going to continue to bail him out all the time. So he'll get one bailout. She knows that. So she loses. Then at some point in time, she may try to vacate the seat. Now, he can agree to anything almost with her because, number one, summer session, you know, they're out in August. There's not a whole lot left on the agenda. And number two, he's going to try, if the House remains Republican, to do away with the vacate rule where one person can do that to the Speaker. So he can kind of hem-haw around it. He does have the edge on her because he knows that Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader, will hold to one vote to spare him. Now, there's another scenario that I have because I saw it happen. Not for control of the House, but I saw it happen of people switching parties. Billy Tozan is the most famous one. 1995, we took control. I was part of that freshman class. Billy Tozan and a couple more members switched. One went independent, then Republican. They switched to the Republican Party. And by the way, when they did it, they didn't go to the minority leader, Gephardt, and say, hey, by the way, we're thinking of switching. No, they just did it. And it caught, you know, the Democrat side off guard. Now, it didn't make the difference because we had a bigger margin, but we still picked up, you know, three seats. And if this gets down to where it's a one or two vote difference, I'm just throwing this out here. Could Hakeem Jeffries get signals maybe from, say, three Republicans who say, hey, I want to switch, And of course, Billy Tozan eventually was rewarded. And by the way, I was in the room when people said, Billy Tozan, you can't make him chairman of Ways and Means, or you can't give him this, or you can't give him that. And they could, because he switched.
Right.
And he got out on the line for us. So I'm just throwing that out there. It's possible if two or three members from the Republican side switched, maybe they got a subcommittee chairmanship. I don't know. Maybe something happens. Maybe one of them got a chairmanship and they switched. That would make it very interesting. And the person who would cause that switch to happen immediately would be Marjorie Taylor Greenames.
There you go. Because they've only got one vote majority right now. And Billy Tozan, you throw that name out. I haven't thought of him in a long time. Ever since he bailed, what was 05 during the Bush years, to go take what was $1 million a year gig working for Big Pharma. I look at that as everything that's wrong with what goes on in Washington. What was that?
Correct.
But as correct. Always, Bob,
especially Big Pharma.
Yeah, oh, crazy. As always, I appreciate the time, the insight. Good stuff. Our good friend Bob Ney. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1863. That was the day that Division I of the Brotherhood of the Footboards was founded in Detroit, Michigan. By the next year, they had changed their name to the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers. In the early years of railroad transportation, the men who worked on the rails worked long hours under tough physical conditions. Any attempt to organize or strike was brutally crushed. The engineers had attempted to organize as early as 1855, but the effort had failed. Convinced the workers needed to join together, William D. Robinson, an engineer who worked out of Michigan, called a meeting. 19 men gathered at his house in Marshall, Michigan. The meeting laid the groundwork for forming a union. The next month, a dozen engineers met in Detroit and elected Robinson as the leader of their new organization. The Brotherhood set up its headquarters in Cleveland, Ohio. Over the summer, they began to organize more divisions. Soon, 10 locals were established across Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio. The next year, the Brotherhood held its first national convention in Indianapolis. The Brotherhood became one of the Big Four labor organizations of railroad workers, alongside the trainmen, firemen, and conductors. The engineers established labor banks and printed a journal, initiatives that helped build their strength. These early railroad brotherhoods were, for the most part, only open to white men to join as members. Working on the vital transportation lines that moved the nation's goods and people gave the Brotherhood leverage at the negotiation table. The Big Four won gains in working hours and conditions that helped to pave the way for unions in many other sectors of the economy. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So it's National Teacher Appreciation Week, the time where we thank our teachers for the hard work that they do, and I want to outreach to them. I know it's tough. I know the attacks are coming from every direction, but I want to thank a teacher. So if you see a teacher, by all means, thank them. Also, it's Public Service Recognition Week, so the folks who work in our public services, make sure that the functions of government are rolling along. By all means, thank them. And National Nurses Week, thank our frontline heroes. Really, all of those folks, all, if you remember during the pandemic, all frontline heroes, all essential. So thank you for the work that you do. Now, it's interesting. I was watching some of these. Sometimes I do fall down the rabbit hole of watching these social media video things, the video crack. And I happened across, and I don't know who these three idiots were, but they were amazed at how much UPS workers make. And not in a good way. This is one of those things where they, can you believe? And my mind immediately went, well, not one of the three of you could actually do the job. So I would shut up on that vein. But it got me to thinking about, you know, these so-called rich guys. And I assume all of them were investor types, you know, because they were all, every time I see them, they're you know, I made money, you know, cheating people on rent or whatever it is. And it got me to thinking about, you know, the job at UPS does pay well. It's hard work. It is stressful, you know, high anxiety, high pressure, all that stuff, and physically demanding. It takes a massive toll on your body as well as your mind. But they make like a top rate, like $49 an hour, which is like $100,000 a year. And I got to thinking about, you know, the reality of where we are. You know, in my working lifetime, I remember when I started working, you know, back in the late 80s, in the freight industry, we were making in today's dollars in that $100,000 range. You know, had our wages kept up with inflation, from that point till now, we would be, you know, right there, because freight used to be the top of the Teamster scale. The LTL freight industry, which was 85% unionized at the time, was at the top. That was the gold standard of blue collar work in this country. It was one of those jobs at the top. And what's happened over the years, and again, this is thank you, Ronald Reagan. Thank you, Republican Party. Those jobs have been eroded away. In the name of competition, of course. In the name of deregulation, of course. And again, Carter had something to do with this. Teddy Kennedy had something to do with it back in the late 70s. But Reagan is when all of this stuff, the wheels fell off the truck, if you will. When they fires the Patco workers, it's the shot heard across the boardroom. And it is an all-out assault on working people. But understand, we were in decline already. We were beginning because corporate America had said, hey, we're not paying anymore. We're not going to pay good wages. You know, as I've said before, 1973, all observers say that was the peak of the U.S. economy for working people. That's when inequality was at its narrowest. That's when the boss and the worker were as close as they've ever been in human history. And because of conservatism, because of pro-business policies, because of the assault on working people, we now are where we are. Where someone who has a good job, and look, that job at UPS is a good job. It's the kind of job you can support a family on with one income. It's the kind that my grandparents' generation, across a wide swath of the middle class, had. And this is the part that's remarkable to me. I listen to these three idiots, you know, blather on, and as if, you know, this is some kind of, you know, some kind of heresy. How dare they make this kind of money? And you go, in my mind, all workers should be making that kind of wealth. And I remember someone telling me years ago that, you know, work doesn't create wealth anymore. My grandparents' generation, they could. You know, they could work, you know, that whole work hard, play by the rules, get ahead thing. They actually did get ahead from work. Now work just kind of keeps holding you back. And, you know, what you used to be able to get defined benefit pensions, they destroyed, eviscerated, getting us to think, hey, we're going to all be millionaires because we're going to get these wonderful 401ks that they didn't fund. If you stop and think about it, the anger in the working class shouldn't be at each other, shouldn't be at people who go to different bathrooms, shouldn't be at any of that, should be at the people at the very top, should be at the wealth class of this country that not only did a bait and switch, but did armed robbery. So for me, I look at this and I go, you know, when do we as a working class defend the jobs at UPS and say, hey, how do we get more of those? How do we get more industries to have that kind of power so that we can gain some of that wealth that our labor creates? That's the part that gets me. I'm always amazed at working people who don't seem to value themselves all that much. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Is your industry, has it kept up over the last 50 years? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Make sure you grab the podcast. As always, thanks so much for being here.
Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com.
Soaring high above La Crosse. This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.